be left unchecked. Every great industrial concern can do as it chooses with its employees and with the general public. Women must be permitted to work as many hours a day as their taskmasters bid them. By contrast, his own party would build on laws recently established to protect the nation's consumers and workers. His new nationalism proposed to use the whole power of the government to protect all those who, under Mr. Wilson's laissez-faire system, are trodden down in the ferocious, scrambling rush of an unregulated and purely individualistic industrialism. Of course, the single line excerpted from Wilson's address did not represent the full measure of the candidate's thinking about governmental power. In other speeches, Wilson articulated his conviction that freedom today is something more than being let alone. In the modern industrial world, he explained, laws were needed to ensure fair play. In keeping with the traditional democratic philosophy, however, Wilson insisted that these laws should emanate from state capitals, not Washington. He understood that expansion of federal power was anathema to the southern base of the Democratic Party, where states' rights safeguarded segregation. Despite his more progressive personal views, Wilson could not abandon his party's historic commitment to the Jeffersonian ideal of a smaller, less expensive federal government. Roosevelt's declaration of war against his opponent's concept of limited national government prompted Wilson to articulate a more positive strategy to expand the nation's prosperity. In a speech at Indianapolis, he called upon his countrymen to open again the fields of competition so that new men with brains, new men with capital, new men with energy in their veins may build up enterprises in America. While Roosevelt accepted trusts as inevitable and strove through centralized federal power to regulate them in the interests of the public, Wilson argued the very size of the corporations posed a problem. He called upon the American people to organize the forces of liberty in our time to make conquest of a new freedom. Wilson's New Freedom slogan caught on, providing a counterpoint to Roosevelt's New Nationalism. Expanding on his theme as the campaign progressed, Wilson argued that the wealth of America lay in its small businesses, its towns and villages. Its vitality does not lie in New York nor in Chicago, he asserted. It will not be sapped by anything that happens in St. Louis. The vitality of America lies in the brains, the energies, the enterprise of the people throughout the land, in the efficiency of their factories, and in the richness of the fields that stretch beyond the borders of the town. By reinforcing the antitrust law and by abolishing tariff favors and credit denials, he would return genuine free enterprise to America. Never one to shy from a fight, Roosevelt delighted in the escalating policy debate with Wilson, vigorously defending his regulatory approach and claiming that Wilson's proposal to break up big corporations defied the realities of modern life. Drawing on his own experience, he pointed out that when the court dissolved Standard Oil, the company simply split up into a lot of smaller companies, which were continued to operate in such close alliance that they remained, in effect, under Standard's control. The result was only higher prices for the consumer and even lower wages for the workers. Only the owners had benefited. "The price of the stock has gone up over 100%, Roosevelt observed, so that Mr. Rockefeller and his associates have actually seen their fortunes doubled by the policy which Mr. Wilson advocates and which Mr. Taft defends." Little wonder, the colonel sardonically concluded, that Wall Street prayed for either Wilson or Taft's policies in preference to his own commitment to put all these companies under a powerful federal commission. By early October, it was becoming more and more plain that the fight was between Wilson and Roosevelt, Oscar Davis remarked. Taft was steadily fading into the background. The Republican Party receded as both frontrunners directed their energies to the task of distinguishing the new freedom from the new nationalism. The two doctrines were as close as fraternal twins compared with the platform embraced by the Socialist Party candidate, Eugene Debs. On the presidential ballot for the fourth time, Debs maintained that the capitalist system was utterly incapable of dealing with the problems of the industrial age. His Socialist Party platform called for the collective ownership of transportation and communication, of land, wherever it was practical, and of the banking system. To ensure more direct democracy, the Socialist platform proposed the abolition of the United States Senate, elimination of the president's veto power, and removal of the Supreme Court's power to declare laws passed by Congress unconstitutional. On the night of October 14th, Roosevelt was scheduled to deliver a speech to a large Milwaukee audience. 2 days earlier, as a bitter wind blew through the open flaps of a mammoth tent on Chicago's west side, Roosevelt had shouted himself so hoarse that he could barely speak beyond a whisper. Over the emphatic resistance of Dr. Terrell, his throat specialist, Roosevelt insisted on honoring his commitment to the people of Milwaukee, which included participating in a parade through the city streets, a banquet at the Gilpatrick Hotel, and a public address. "I want to be a good Indian," Roosevelt declared. An open touring car stood in front of the hotel, waiting to convey the Roosevelt party to the auditorium following dinner. Roosevelt entered first, followed by Henry Cocombs, head of the Progressive Party's Speakers Bureau. Gathered on the opposite curb, the crowd started clapping and cheering. Roosevelt acknowledged the ovation by standing and doffing his hat. At that moment, a man at the front of the crowd raised a large pistol and fired. It was point-blank range, Oscar Davis observed, and almost impossible to miss. As the bullet hit the right side of the colonel's chest, he lurched and collapsed on the seat. Just as the man with the gun prepared to fire a second shot, Roosevelt's stenographer, Elbert Martin, leapt on the assailant. A former football player, Martin quickly disarmed the attacker and began to strangle him. "I wasn't going to take him prisoner," Martin later admitted. "I was trying to kill him." The inflamed crowd spurred him on, shouting, "Lynch him! Kill him!" In the midst of the chaos, Roosevelt struggled to his feet and called out to his stenographer. "Bring him here," he ordered. "Don't hurt him." Martin grudgingly obeyed, dragging the man toward the car. Roosevelt lifted his would-be assassin's head to look directly at his face. "What did you do it for?" Roosevelt asked. But marking the dead expression in the man's eyes, he added, "Oh, what's the use? Turn him over to the police." Falling back on his seat once again, Roosevelt ordered the chauffeur to go straight to the auditorium against the insistence of Dr. Terrell, who demanded that they stop first at the emergency room of the hospital to examine the wound. "You get me to that speech," Roosevelt shouted. Only when they reached the green room in the auditorium did Roosevelt allow the doctor to look closely at the wound, which was located just under his right nipple. It was bleeding slightly, Oscar Davis noted, the blood spot on his white shirt being about the size of a man's hand. Unable to determine where the bullet had lodged, Dr. Terrell again demanded a thorough hospital examination. "It's all right," Roosevelt said, inhaling deeply several times. "I don't get any pain from this breathing." And, with a handkerchief secured to his chest as a bandage, Roosevelt headed for the stage. When told of the shooting, the audience cried out in shock, but Roosevelt quieted them down. "It's true," he informed them, "but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose." He withdrew his spectacles and his speech from the inside pocket of his coat. The speech had been typed on 50 heavy sheets of paper folded in half to fit into his breast pocket. Seeing the hole the bullet had ripped through the pages and the dented spectacle case, Roosevelt suddenly understood how narrowly he had escaped. Indeed, the bullet would have gone straight into his heart if it had not been deflected upward by the buffering combination of his thick manuscript and metal eyeglass case. Instead, the bullet struck the fourth rib on the right side, fracturing the bone, but coming to a halt. Roosevelt had spoken for about half an hour when Oscar Davis, standing by the side of the stage, noticed that the color had drained from his face and he was laboring very hard to go on. He approached the colonel, suggesting that he bring the speech to a close.
"No, sir," Roosevelt replied with ferocious expression. "I will not stop until I have finished."
Though his heart was racing, he ignored the knife-like pain in his ribs and continued to speak for an additional hour. Finally reaching the last page of the script, he turned to Dr. Terrell and murmured, "Now I am ready to go with you and do what you want." As Roosevelt was examined at the hospital, police interrogated the attacker, John F. Schrank. A 36-year-old former saloon keeper from the east side of Manhattan, Schrank produced a written manifesto that described a dream in which President McKinley had risen from his coffin and indicted Roosevelt as his murderer. He told police that he had first begun to think seriously of Roosevelt as a menace to his country when he heard the colonel shout "thief" at the Republican convention and announce his decision to run for a third term on a new party. "Any man looking for a third term ought to be shot," he said. He was fully persuaded, Schrank declared, that if Colonel Roosevelt was defeated at the fall election, he would again cry "thief," and that his action would plunge the country into a bloody civil war. He had followed Roosevelt to Charleston, New Orleans, Atlanta, and Chattanooga, Schrank confessed, with the intention of shooting him. But the right opportunity had never presented itself. At the Milwaukee hospital, Roosevelt was in good spirits, joking with doctors as they examined the wound and took x-rays to reveal the location of the bullet. The decision was made to transfer him to Mercy Hospital in Chicago, where chest surgeons would determine if they needed to operate to remove the bullet. "There are only three possible dangers," Roosevelt explained to reporters when he reached Mercy Hospital: "pleurisy, pneumonia, and blood poisoning. If we can get safely past these three, there isn't a thing in the world to prevent me from resuming my campaign." President Taft was at New York's Hotel Astor to attend a banquet in honor of his cabinet when the head of the Associated Press approached his table with news of the shooting. All over the room, conversation died down, the New York Tribune reported. Whispers of Roosevelt and "impossible" were heard. The dinner guests got up from their tables to rush to the telephones. Later that night, Taft issued a short statement to the press and sent a sympathetic telegram to Roosevelt the following morning. Wilson offered to suspend his campaign while his opponent remained hospitalized, but Roosevelt swiftly declined his offer. "The fight should go on to its conclusion, just as it would in case of battle, even though the commanding general might be struck down." Edith Roosevelt had been enjoying a musical comedy in New York City when she received word of the attack on her husband. She left the theater and straightaway made arrangements to travel to Chicago the following day, accompanied by Theodore Jr., Ethel, and the family doctor, Alexander Lambert. "It's the best news I've heard since I got here," Roosevelt said. Edith took command as soon as she reached the hospital, consulting with the medical staff, limiting visitation, and making sure that her husband followed the doctor's orders. "He has been as meek as a lamb since the boss arrived," noted the New York Times correspondent. Despite Roosevelt's plea to let more people into his room, she insisted that he needed rest. "This thing about ours being a campaign against boss rule is a fake," he said with chagrin. "I never was so boss-ruled in my life as I am at this moment." By the following Saturday, doctors determined that the danger of infection was past, that the bullet was lodged outside of the rib, and could, most likely, be allowed to live there permanently. The colonel's color and appetite had returned, though his broken rib continued to make it painful to breathe. So long as he remained in absolute quiet for several days, the hospital medical staff agreed to release him after the weekend. By Monday morning, Roosevelt was cleared to leave the hospital. The ambulance transferred him to his railroad car, where he slept and read until the train reached New York. "I'm in fine shape," Roosevelt reported to Bammy a few days later. Though the wound remained open and the doctors would not allow him to return to the campaign trail, the indomitable colonel still hoped to make one final appearance at Madison Square Garden at the end of October, the week before the election. Although the shooting forced the cancellation of scores of campaign events, the dramatic attack upon the stalwart and stoic former president rekindled the nation's empathy, and speculation swirled about how it might reshape the election. "Encouraging reports are coming in from all over," Ethel Roosevelt reported to Bammy. "Things look better for us than they ever have." While immense crowds continued to cheer Governor Wilson at every stop of his final campaign tour, a Democratic speaker at an Oakland rally articulated the worst fears of the Wilson camp. "The bullet that rests in Roosevelt's chest has killed Wilson for the presidency," he said. Taft recognized the difficulty of anticipating the political impact of such an event. With his usual equanimity, he took a more philosophical approach to the furor. What effect the incident will have on the election, he remarked, is difficult to conjecture. Special precautions were taken to protect Roosevelt from the rush of the crowd as he made his way to Madison Square Garden on October 30th to deliver his Farewell Manifesto. At dinner with Edith and Dr. Lambert earlier that evening, the colonel had expressed surprise that the simple journey to the city had fatigued him, but he looked to the excitement of the moment to carry him through. Aware that his voice had not regained its accustomed power, he was anxious to begin speaking as soon as he took the stage. Catching sight of him, however, the audience of 16,000 would not stop a spontaneous and emotional tribute that poured forth for 42 minutes, despite Roosevelt's best efforts to dampen the crowd. "Perhaps once in a generation," Roosevelt began, "there comes a chance for the people of a country to play their part wisely and fearlessly in some great battle of the age-long warfare for human rights. Perhaps less dramatic than the struggles their fathers and forefathers had faced, the battle for social justice was well nigh as important. If the problems created by the industrial age were left unattended," Roosevelt cautioned, "America would eventually be sundered by those dreadful lines of division that set the haves and the have-nots against one another. We know that there are in life injustices which we are powerless to remedy," Roosevelt acknowledged. "But we know also that there is much injustice which can be remedied. The Progressive Party," he pledged, "would harness the collective power of the people through their governmental agencies to move the country forward. We propose to lift the burdens from the lowly and the weary, from the poor and the oppressed," the colonel asserted. "We propose to stand for the sacred rights of childhood and womanhood. Nay, more, we propose to see that manhood is not crushed out of the men who toil by excessive hours of labor, by underpayment, by injustice and oppression. Surely there never was a fight better worth making than this." And finally, contemplating this cause so much larger than any individual, Roosevelt concluded, "Win or lose, I am glad beyond measure that I am one of the many who in this fight have stood ready to spend and be spent." Throughout, his face and manner revealed strain, but the colonel's voice was as clear as a bell. Those who had witnessed scores of earlier appearances felt they heard a new Roosevelt on this night, free from the old violence and the old sarcasm. He uttered not a single word against his opponents, focusing his remarks solely on the principles for which the Progressive Party stood. Even his nemesis, the New York Sun, praised his lyrical and passionate presentation, lauding the good taste he exhibited in avoiding the temptation to misuse an unparalleled opportunity for self-exhibition. On the Friday before the election, President Taft sat down with New York World reporter Louis Siebold for an extended interview. Aware that his chance for outright victory was small, Taft nevertheless hoped to outpoll Roosevelt. A frank discussion of the circumstances surrounding his break with Roosevelt, the reporter suggested, might help to influence public opinion. "Taft was in excellent spirits," Siebold later recalled. The lengthy conversation, transcribed by the president's stenographer, was scheduled to run the following day, not only in the World, but in newspapers across the country, through release to the Associated Press. When he entered the presidency, Taft explained, he had been anxious to carry out the promises of the platform, but he was hindered by long-developing factions within the Republican Party. Asked by Siebold if Roosevelt had fomented these factions, Taft cast no blame. "No," he replied, "the party naturally divided itself. The rupture was caused by a widening division between Eastern manufacturing interests desiring a high protective tariff and Western farmers calling for serious tariff reductions. He had moved in the right direction when he signed the Payne bill, but the genius of publicity," the president admitted, "was an attribute he never possessed." The training of a judge is something that leads you to depend upon the opinion published and the decree entered as speaking for themselves, he reflected. endeavoring to justify his lack of engagement with the press. As a result, he never properly educated the country about the benefits of the tariff bill, the corporation tax, or any of the other measures he was proud to have passed. When the reporter sought Taft's comment on anything beyond the personal ambition of Mr. Roosevelt that had propelled the former president into the race, Taft demurred. There had been personalities enough in the pre-convention campaign, he cryptically remarked. Under Siebold's persistent probing to explain the bitterness of Roosevelt's commentary during the primary contest, Taft eventually offered a benign explanation. Mr. Roosevelt is so constituted that it is impossible for him to go into a controversy without becoming personal. Roosevelt had once told him that in every fight he strove to get close up to a man, attacking not only the man's argument, but the man himself. He could not ascribe to the man differing from him radically any other than an improper motive. Would Roosevelt have entered the race if he had foreseen the wrecking of the Republican Party? Siebold asked. I cannot tell, Taft replied, loath to publicly ascribe malicious motives to Roosevelt. I don't think he went deliberately into it that way, noting that Roosevelt was not a planner, but simply a man who acts from day to day. Taft himself remained in a philosophical state as he considered the upcoming election. I have had to be. The experience I have had in the presidency has made me so, he explained, and what I am very hopeful is that whatever happens, the country will go on to ultimate happiness. Following the interview, Siebold was told he could have the transcript upon its completion, but later that afternoon he received word that the president wanted time to make minor corrections. Taft invited the reporter to join him on the evening train to New York as the presidential party traveled to attend the funeral of Vice President James Sherman, who had died from heart disease 2 days earlier. The reporter agreed, but emphasized the practical need to get the interview into production. Space was being saved in every newspaper. Still, Taft procrastinated, insisting that he needed time for edits and furthermore wanted to consult Root and Wickersham when the train reached New York. I'm afraid that's too late, Siebold warned. But Roosevelt was my closest friend, Taft objected. The interview never ran. On election eve, Taft arrived in his home city of Cincinnati following a 28-hour train ride from New York. He had chosen a leisurely route through Ohio, allowing him to greet and visit the friendly crowds gathered at train stations along the way. He refrained from mentioning politics, indulging instead in pleasantries about the prosperous economy and local events. Upon reaching Cincinnati, Taft went directly to his brother Charlie's mansion, where he would receive election returns among family and friends. Nellie had not made the trip, accompanying Helen and young Charlie to New York, where the Republican National Committee chair had arranged a small dinner party. On election day, November 5th, Taft reportedly slept late, ate a good breakfast, smiled profusely, and acted generally as though some 16 million men were not voting on the subject of his political fate. At noon, he motored to his regular polling place on Madison Road, stopping first to visit Nick Longworth, who was in a tight race to retain his congressional seat. The polling place was crowded, but the president stood in line and waited his turn, chatting with friends and posing for pictures. After casting his vote, Taft spent a quiet afternoon at his brother's Pike Street house. Roosevelt passed a busy morning, catching up on his voluminous correspondence. At noon, he motored to the small firehouse in Oyster Bay where he traditionally cast his vote. Accompanied by his gardeners, coachmen, and chauffeur, he was greeted with cheers from a crowd of villagers. After signing the register, he headed toward the booth. "Here goes another Bull Mooser vote," a man shouted, eliciting a broad smile from the colonel. That afternoon, Theodore and Edith took a long ramble in the woods before returning to dress for dinner and prepare for the election returns. After a final campaigning push the night before the election, Woodrow Wilson returned home to Princeton, thrilled to be back with his family on election day. He felt like a boy out of school on a lark, he told reporters that morning, relieved that for once he didn't have to jump out and make a speech somewhere. After breakfast, Wilson walked to his polling place at the Chambers Street Fire Station. Directly across the street stood the boarding house where he had lived more than 3 decades earlier when he came to Princeton as a college freshman. Wilson had spent the better part of his life in Princeton, Ray Baker noted, and he knew every nook and corner of the old town. After casting his vote, Wilson had lunch with his wife and daughters, answered letters, posed for press photographs, and took a walk through the countryside with his secretary and an old friend. The small dinner party at Wilson's home that night, the New York Times reported, was much in the nature of a celebration, for every minute or two it was interrupted by messages from the telegraph room, every one of which brought news that the tide was running strongly in the governor's favor. Before long, such bulletins made it clear to both the president and the former president that neither man could win the election. By the time Taft and Roosevelt sat down for dinner, an air of gloom and despondency pervaded both Pike Street and Sagamore Hill. Official word of Governor Wilson's victory was confirmed after 10 p.m. via telegraph. Ellen Wilson delivered the welcome news to her husband, who stood talking to friends before a bright fire in the parlor. "My dear," she said, kissing him, "I want to be the first to congratulate you." The bells atop historic Nassau Hall began to ring, and soon several thousand Princeton students arrived at Wilson's house, waving flags and carrying torches. Speaking with great emotion, even with tears in his eyes, Wilson told the students he understood the serious challenges he faced. "I look almost with pleading to you, the young men of America, to stand behind me, to support me in the new administration." Wilson had achieved an immense victory in the Electoral College. He captured 40 of the 48 states, bringing him 435 electoral votes. Roosevelt took 6 states, producing 88 votes. Taft won only Vermont and Utah, for a total of 8 electoral votes. The popular vote was somewhat less emphatic. Wilson won nearly 6.3 million votes compared to 4.1 million for Roosevelt and a little short of 3.5 million for Taft. Eugene Debs secured over 900,000 votes, the highest vote total the Socialist Party had ever reached. The split between Taft and Roosevelt had clearly hurt both men. Their combined vote exceeded Wilson's by nearly 1.3 million. And together, they had captured over 50% of the electorate, leaving only 41.9% with the new president, Woodrow Wilson. At 11:30 p.m., President Taft sent a warm congratulatory telegram to Governor Wilson, extending his best wishes for a successful administration. By then, it was already clear that Taft had suffered an overwhelming defeat, coming in third behind Wilson and Roosevelt. 4 years earlier, Taft had celebrated victory with dozens of jubilant friends. On that auspicious night, several thousand of his fellow townsmen with blatant horns and red fire thronged about the mansion. On this night, the streets were deserted, and the only persons in the vicinity were the policemen on guard around the house. As news of Wilson's victory came over the wires, Roosevelt sent word to the press that he would receive them at 11 o'clock. They went in rather more subdued than usual, the New York Times reported, filled with a great curiosity to see just how he was taking the defeat. He was seated at his desk, with a logwood blaze shining softly from the big fireplace when the group of journalists arrived. "Now, old friends," Roosevelt remarked, "I'm really glad to see you." He then proceeded to recite from memory the telegram he had sent to the president-elect. "The American people, by a great plurality, have conferred upon you the highest honor in their gift. I congratulate you thereon." After finishing, he laughed softly and said, "That's all." Not surprisingly, Roosevelt was hit harder by the defeat than the president, who appeared to make a quick recovery. As Taft boarded the train for his return to Washington, he chatted as gaily as he did before the election, appearing to reporters as if a great load had been taken from his shoulders. He acknowledged that while he had been hopeful that he might secure victory in a close election, he had not been so hopeful that he had experienced any shock of real disappointment. To a lifelong friend, he humbly explained his composure. "The people of the United States did not owe me another election. I hope that I am properly grateful for the one term of the presidency which they gave me. and the fact that they withheld the second is no occasion for my resentment or feeling of injustice. Most importantly, he reflected to another friend, as I look back over the record of the administration, I feel very well satisfied that a great deal was accomplished which will be useful to the people in the future. And that, after all, is the only real satisfaction one gets out of any public service. While Roosevelt had been realistic about his chances, he was deeply unsettled by the magnitude of the loss. In the 2 weeks following the attempt on his life, there had been such an outpouring of popular feeling, Edith explained to Kermit, that progressive leaders felt victory might truly be possible, not only for Roosevelt, but for the party. When the election returns were fully counted, progressives actually captured but a single governorship and a dozen congressional seats. The Democrats not only increased their majority in the House, but also seized control of the Senate for the first time in nearly two decades. There is no use disguising the fact that the defeat at the polls is overwhelming, a disappointed Roosevelt wrote his British friend Arthur Hamilton Lee, allowing that he had expected we would make a better showing. Several days later, his assessment appeared darker as he told Gifford Pinchot, "We must face the fact that our cutting loose from the Republican Party was followed by disaster to the progressive cause in most of the states where it won 2 years ago." Only in time did Roosevelt's perspective on defeat grow more sanguine. It was a phenomenal thing to be able to bring the new party into second place and beat out the Republicans, he told Henry White, recognizing the remarkable achievement of an association that had, in a mere 3 months, managed to gather more support than a sitting president and defeat a political party that had held sway over national politics for 50 years. In the aftermath of the election, Roosevelt reiterated to the papers his view that the leader for the time being is of little consequence, but the cause itself must triumph, for its triumph is essential to the well-being of the American people. Rather than a rationalization to assuage the bitterness of his loss, his statement would prove remarkably prescient. Although the Progressive Party met defeat, the progressive causes would continue to influence American politics for years to come. Within the coming decade alone, three signal amendments would be added to the Constitution. The 16th, giving the national government the power to levy a progressive income tax, without which many of the New Deal's social programs might not have been possible. The 17th, providing for the popular election of United States senators, and the 19th, finally granting American women the right to vote. While William Howard Taft had assumed the role of the conservative during the presidential race, he too had long since rejected the laissez-faire philosophy that had dominated politics since the Civil War, committing himself instead to the core progressive belief that government had a responsibility to remedy social problems, improve working conditions, safeguard public health, and protect our natural heritage. Though the two men had strikingly different temperaments, Roosevelt's original and active nature at odds with Taft's ruminative and judicial disposition, their opposing qualities actually proved complementary, allowing them to forge a powerful camaraderie and rare collaboration. There was a time, at the height of their careers, when Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft stood shoulder to shoulder as they charted a different role for our government that would fundamentally enlarge the bounds of economic opportunity and social justice. Epilogue. On May 26, 1918, 6 years after the election that ended his presidency and fractured his party, William Howard Taft arrived for a conference at Chicago's Blackstone Hotel. As Taft was retiring to his room upstairs, the elevator operator informed him that Colonel Roosevelt was presently seated alone in the dining room. "I hear he's leaving right away," the young man remarked. Taft did not hesitate. "Then I'll ask you to take me back downstairs," he responded. After the White House, Taft had become the Kent Professor of Constitutional Law at Yale, a position that offered intellectual engagement, the camaraderie of a cherished college campus, and the freedom to lecture around the country. Roosevelt had found his own solace through a combination of writing, speaking, and intense physical activity. The election no sooner behind him, he had begun work on his autobiography. Completing that project within 10 months, he embarked on an expedition to explore the River of Doubt, an uncharted tributary of the mighty Amazon. Returning home, he occupied himself writing dozens of articles and delivering scores of speeches each year. He had stopped at the Blackstone Hotel on his way to Des Moines, where the following day he was scheduled to deliver 3 speeches. Over the years, since the contentious 1912 election, mutual friends and political allies had repeatedly tried to reunite Roosevelt and Taft, but their infrequent meetings had been neither cordial nor intimate, marked by what Taft deemed armed neutrality. In 1915, they had both served as honorary pallbearers at the funeral of Yale professor Thomas Lounsbery. Taft made the first overture, extending his hand to Roosevelt. "How are you, Theodore?" he asked. The colonel merely shook hands silently, without smiling, and no further communication passed between them. A year later, in early October of 1916, Elihu Root had arranged for the two men to appear at a Union League Club reception for Republican presidential nominee Charles Evans Hughes. Organized with the goal of cementing the union of progressives and Republicans against Woodrow Wilson, Republicans hailed the event as a big love feast. Though Roosevelt's presence was calculated to symbolize his return to the Republican fold, Taft told Nellie they simply shook hands with a howdy-do, and that was all. Only when grave illness hospitalized Roosevelt in early February of 1918 did the possibility open for a genuine reconciliation. Learning that the colonel was enduring an operation to remove a fistula, much like the ordeal he had suffered through when he was governor general, Taft sent a sympathetic telegram to Roosevelt. "I know something of the pain and discomfort he is passing through," Taft wrote to Nellie, adding that from the tone of the dispatches, he suspected that Roosevelt's condition was far more serious than his had been. In fact, the colonel had never recovered from the malaria contracted during his expedition to the River of Doubt, leaving him prone to fever and infection. During this most recent bout of fever, a rectal abscess had developed, along with abscesses in both ears. The surgery to remedy these conditions proved successful, but persistent fever and severe nausea required him to remain in the hospital for almost a month. The first message he personally sent was to thank Taft. "I'm rather rocky," he acknowledged, "but greatly touched and pleased by your message." This written exchange, the first in 6 years, led Roosevelt to send Taft a draft of a speech he would deliver in late March. An indictment of Wilson's handling of America's participation in World War I, the piece was entitled, "Speed Up the War and Take Thought for After the War." The piece criticized the administration for sluggishness in making war and called for longer hours of work in war plants and for universal military training to be continued after the war. Taft wholeheartedly concurred with Roosevelt's critique of Wilson's wartime leadership. He carefully read the draft and made 2 recommendations. "I have embodied both of those suggestions," Roosevelt wrote in response. "I think them capital. I'm rather ashamed I never thought of them myself, and I am malevolently pleased that neither Root nor Lodge thought of them." These cordial exchanges renewed Taft's optimism that Roosevelt might finally be ready to reconcile. Hurrying across the Blackstone's dining room, which was bustling with nearly 100 diners, he spotted the colonel at a small table by the corner window. "Theodore," he exclaimed, "I am glad to see you." Roosevelt rose from his seat and grasped Taft's shoulders. "Well, I am indeed delighted to see you. Won't you sit down?" All across the room, customers rose from their dinners, and waitstaff paused, recognizing the significance of the meeting. Suddenly, the chamber erupted into applause. New York Tribune reporter John Leary, who was traveling with Roosevelt, heard the loud ovation from the lobby. Joined by curious members of the hotel staff, he started up the stairs leading to the dining room. Encountering a patron who had witnessed the hoopla, he asked what had incited the outburst. "T.R. and Taft's got together," the man exclaimed. "They're holding an old home week." "By Godfrey, I never was so surprised in my life," Roosevelt later told Leary. "I no more thought of him being in Chicago than in Timbuktu. But wasn't it a gracious thing for him to do?" There was so much commotion when they first greeted each other, he explained, that he could hardly hear what Taft was saying. I don't mind telling you how delighted I am, Roosevelt added. I never felt happier over anything in my life. It was splendid of Taft. The two men talked together like a pair of happy schoolboys until Roosevelt had to depart to catch the night train to Des Moines. Taft was beaming, one witness reported, and Colonel Roosevelt, leaning half across the table, was expressing himself very earnestly. Meeting Leary on the way out, Taft could not disguise his elation. "Isn't he looking splendid?" he exclaimed. "I never saw him looking much better." Asked about the nature of their conversation, Taft simply replied that they discussed patriotism and the state and welfare of the nation. His smile suggested that a far more important exchange had occurred. Describing the meeting a week later to Henry Stimson, Roosevelt confided that at long last they had completely renewed the old friendly relations. 7 months later, on Christmas Day, 1918, after a 6-week hospital stay for a severe attack of inflammatory rheumatism, Theodore Roosevelt returned to convalesce at Sagamore Hill. Though delighted to be back in his beloved home, Roosevelt was still in considerable pain. Doctors predicted a full recovery, but Edith hired a nurse to attend to his medical needs and contacted James Amos, the black valet who had served Roosevelt in the White House. Her husband, she explained to Amos, would not allow anyone else to help, but they understood that it might be difficult for him to come. Amos never hesitated. He packed a suitcase and made arrangements to remain by Roosevelt's side as long as he was needed. By the following Sunday morning, January 5, 1919, Roosevelt seemed better again. Comfortably situated in the warmest room in the house, the large bedroom that had once been the children's nursery, he dictated letters and proofread an editorial for Metropolitan Magazine, calling on the country to give women the right to vote. There should be no further delay, he emphatically stated. The war was over. The time had come to focus on domestic issues. It is an absurdity to longer higgle about the matter. Together, Edith and Theodore passed a happy and wonderful day, she later recalled. He had long treasured the view of the water from that corner room, and as it got dusk, he watched the dancing of waves and spoke with happiness of being home and made little plans for me. I think he had made up his mind, she wrote, that he would have to suffer for some time to come, and with his high courage had adjusted himself to bear it. He was very sweet all day. At around 10 o'clock that night, Theodore told Edith he felt a curious sensation of depression about the chest, almost as though his heart were preparing to stop. I know it is not going to happen, he assured her, but it is such a strange feeling. Edith called their family physician, Dr. Fowler, who examined him carefully, found no indication of anything wrong with heart and lungs, and after giving him a slight stimulant, left him. While Edith prepared to retire, Amos helped Roosevelt get settled for the night. The colonel remained for a short time on the sofa before turning to his valet. James, don't you think I might go to bed now? Amos took off Roosevelt's robe and had almost to lift him into bed. Edith returned to give her husband a goodnight kiss, after which Roosevelt said, James, will you please put out the light? Edith came to check on her husband shortly after midnight and again 2 hours later. Finding him in a peaceful slumber, she departed for her room. Amos rested in a chair not far from the bed. Shortly before 4 o'clock, the valet was alarmed by the sound of irregular breathing. Roosevelt's respiration seemed to stop, he later said. Then it resumed again and paused again. Amos rushed to summon the nurse and alerted Mrs. Roosevelt. By the time Edith reached his room, Theodore was dead. Doctors later confirmed that Roosevelt had died in his sleep from a coronary embolism. Death had to take him sleeping, Vice President Thomas Marshall cabled from Washington. For if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight. Ray Baker, Ida Tarbell, and William Allen White were all in Paris on separate assignments covering the armistice and the Versailles Peace Conference when news of Roosevelt's death reached Europe. Their brave little adventure in creating a writer's magazine dedicated to serious public issues, had failed. Relentless money troubles had forced John Phillips to sell The American to a big publishing house, which pressured the writers to satisfy advertisers' demands for popular pieces. The test of the stories, Baker lamented, became not whether they were good literature or important contributions to national discourse, but whether they would attract 600,000 readers. Prize contests were introduced, along with stories of romance and marriage. Baker had been tempted to leave in 1912 when the new publishers demanded that he remove a sentence critical of the business community. Loyalty to his colleagues had kept him on board for 3 additional years, until he could no longer abide the way his literary ambitions were continuously being strangled by commercial considerations, and finally resigned. In short order, Tarbell, Phillips, and White also resigned. White and Tarbell had been sent to Paris by the Red Cross magazine, where John Phillips was now the editor. Ray Baker was serving President Wilson as press liaison, assigned to give daily briefings to over 100 American correspondents who had journeyed overseas to report on the peace conference. Tarbell observed that Baker managed his demanding job with such absolute fairness that even the tongues of some of the most bumptious journalists were silenced. The 3 old colleagues had taken rooms in the Hôtel de Vouillemont, located just off the Place de la Concorde, not far from the headquarters of the American Peace Commission. There were hours when it seemed like a gathering in the office of the old American magazine, Tarbell recalled, so natural and intimate it was. White was at breakfast when he read of Theodore Roosevelt's death in the Paris Herald's morning edition. "Again and again I looked at the headlines to be sure that I was reading them correctly," he recalled. Just then Ray Baker arrived, carrying the same paper. "Ray, Ray, the colonel is dead. Roosevelt!" White cried. "Yes, Will," Baker responded, sadly embracing White. "It's a great blow. We are all sorry." Soon Ida Tarbell joined them, White recalled, and the 3 sat down to talk it all over and get used to a world without Roosevelt in it. William Howard Taft was among the 500 guests invited to attend Roosevelt's private funeral service held in the modest Episcopal Church in Oyster Bay. "It was my father's wish," Archie Roosevelt explained, "that the funeral service be conducted entirely by those friends among whom he had lived so long and happily." After their fortuitous meeting at the Blackstone Hotel, Roosevelt and Taft had resumed their old habit of intimate, friendly correspondence, sending each other drafts of speeches, commenting on articles, sharing thoughts on the central issues of the day. Visiting Roosevelt in the hospital in late November, Taft had discovered with delight that they were in essential accord on the need for a League of Nations to enforce the post-war peace. Snow had fallen the morning that Theodore Roosevelt was laid to rest, but the sun had come out by the time Taft arrived at the church. "You're a dear personal friend," Archie said, taking him by the hand and directing him to a pew in the front. Though the half-hour service had no pomp, no ceremony, no singing or music, its very simplicity, one mourner observed, made it profoundly impressive. The village bells tolled as mourners followed the casket up the hill to the gravesite, where a mound of flowers hid the freshly turned earth. According to an old widow's custom, Edith Roosevelt attended neither funeral nor burial. Though she would live until 87, she had lost the only man she would ever love. The man, she had told Theodore, she loved with all the passion of a girl who had never loved before. As Theodore Roosevelt's casket was lowered into the ground, an isolated figure stood quite apart from the others, William Howard Taft, softly crying. "I want to say to you," Taft later told Roosevelt's sister Bammy, "how glad I am that Theodore and I came together after that long, painful interval. Had he died in a hostile state of mind toward me, I would have mourned the fact all my life. I loved him always and cherish his memory." At noon on October 3, 1921, 64-year-old William Howard Taft finally secured the position he had long desired as strongly as a man can ever want anything. The death of Chief Justice Edward White the previous May had created a vacancy that President Warren Harding was happy to fill with the former chief executive. In a ceremony witnessed by Nellie and dozens of old friends, Taft took the judicial oath to administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to the poor and to the rich. Reporters noted that the famous Taft smile was irresistible as friends and colleagues rushed up to congratulate him. After the ceremony, Taft and Nellie joined the other justices and their families at a White House reception. "This is the greatest day of my life," the new Chief Justice of the United States declared. "The people of the United States greet Mr. Taft in his new role," the Washington Post editorialized the following day. "Their good wishes will not be inspired solely by their abiding faith in his wisdom and justice, but also by the fact that they like him personally. His popularity throughout the country has grown from the day, nearly 10 years ago, when the fortunes of political warfare went overwhelmingly against him. And instead of permitting defeat to sour his nature or crush his spirit, he accepted his lot philosophically and with a smile." The public trust was not misplaced. Under Taft's able leadership, antiquated court procedure was streamlined, speeding up and greatly improving the delivery of justice throughout the whole system of federal courts. And through his great skill and patience, Taft finally secured from Congress the funds to construct a separate building for the Supreme Court, allowing the justices to move from the old Senate chamber to the classic marble structure that graces Washington today. As Taft had always suspected, the position of Chief Justice was more suited to his mind and temperament than the presidency had ever been. Fulfilled at work and happy at home, he embarked upon a successful regime of diet and exercise, bringing his weight down to less than 250 pounds, a reasonable weight for a man of his stature and proportions. Years of obesity, however, had already damaged his health. On February 3, 1930, escalating heart trouble forced his resignation from the job he had loved more than any other. "We call you Chief Justice still," Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a week later on behalf of his colleagues, "for we cannot give up the title by which we have known you all these later years and which you have made so dear to us. You showed us in new form your voluminous capacity for getting work done, your humor that smoothed the tough places, your golden heart that brought you love from every side, and most of all, from your brethren, whose tasks you have made happy and light." Less than a month after he left the bench, on March 8, 1930, William Howard Taft was dead. Nellie Taft, whose catastrophic illness left her husband bereft of his most valuable ally and altered his presidency in ways the public never comprehended, would live 13 years more, dying just short of her 82nd birthday. During the 1920s and the 1930s, the members of the original McClure's magazine staff continued to celebrate each other's birthdays. Such was the unbreakable quality in friendship, Ida Tarbell marveled, that despite the bitter 1906 split, the core group could not be permanently alienated. "You pick up at the day when the friendship was not broken, but interrupted," she observed. Year after year, the old crowd would convene, reviving 100, yes, 1,000 memories of the days that had proved the most fulfilling of their lives, the idealistic time when they genuinely believed, in Ray Baker's words, that they were saving the world. Sustained by passion and optimism, they muckraked never to destroy, but with utter faith in reason and progress, they criticized in full confidence that, once understood, evils would be speedily corrected. None of them had truly realized, he later acknowledged to Lincoln Steffens, how hard-boiled the world really was. At each of these collective birthday celebrations, Sam McClure, then in his 70s and 80s, was the star of the evening. He would recount his personal history with such charm, his impoverished youth, his marriage to Hattie when his weekly salary was only $12, his eventual triumph storming the sacred citadels in the publishing business, that his listeners were riveted as if the tale were novel. "His old fire flared up," Tarbell was happy to see. We sat enthralled, she wrote, as McClure enlarged on his latest enthusiasm, marveling as always at the eternal youthfulness of the man, the failure of life to quench him. After Phillips was unable to attend one of these gatherings, Tarbell wrote to explain how much he had been missed, how they all realized that he was the one, during all those years, who had kept McClure's flame steady and lasting. Revisiting that wonderful adventure we all had together, Phillips confessed to Ray Baker, was almost like a physical pain, not because of you and me and so on, but because of this country, and because those sincere attempts to do something in reporting and interpretation of what was good and sound and progressive seemed lost and forgotten. Still, he hoped that other times of awakening lay ahead, that a new generation of journalists would be drawn to the work that seemed, once, almost a mission and a call.
The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism was written by Doris Kearns Goodwin and read by Edward Herman. It was recorded by Erica Weintraub and Christina Pachano, with additional recording at Beat Street Studios in New York. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The music, The Good Old USA, was written by Theodore F. Morse and performed by Anthony DeMar. The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, was directed by Carol Shapiro and Erica Weintraub and produced by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.